Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today we'll have news about an East County school board member facing allegations of voter fraud. On Green Scene, hear about a landmark climate plan from federal agencies that directly contradicts the Trump administration's views on climate change. In Lemon Grove, hear why efforts to put a new marijuana initiative on the ballot have been snuffed out by a judge. The county is looking for new homes for 127 cats seized from a single home in Lakeside, and we'll have details. Plus, hear about annual safety steps your household should take to be protected against fires and carbon monoxide leaks. On Bookshelf, author Donald Harrison will talk about his new book, 77 Miles of Jewish Stories, Finding Tales Along Every Interstate 8 Exit in San Diego County. From Public News Service, we'll have national news headlines, including details on a mass shooting in Texas at a church, immigrant protections in legal limbo, and the demise of a news outlet in California. We'll also have the latest on the flu outbreak here in San Diego. And finally, we'll take you on the road to Julian as we replay one of our Best of East County episodes, talking with a Julian historian about the region's colorful past that dates to the post-Civil War era. We'll also chat with a gold panning expert, send our interns into a gold mine, and chat with a pastry shop owner about the new gold, apple pies, drawing visitors to Julian, still a welcoming place for all, roughly 150 years after those first freed slaves and former Confederate soldiers settled the town.
This is Gene Carpenter with a report from the Times of San Diego on voter fraud allegations now being faced by La Mesa Spring Valley School District's newly appointed board member. Rebecca Bassan, a 25-year-old church secretary appointed in August to fill a vacancy, earlier drew controversy for being appointed by the all-Republican board over two other applicants with extensive qualifications, including a past teachers union president and a PTA president who previously served on the bond oversight committee. Now, Times of San Diego reports on new revelations indicating that Bassan voted in a Georgia election last November, despite swearing that she has been a resident of La Mesa Spring Valley District for a year and a half. Bassan lived in Georgia from age 12 until about 3 years ago, when she enrolled in a Bible college in Murrieta. David Lublin, a Harvard-trained PhD and elections expert at American University in Washington, D.C., says, "Voting in Georgia long after she claimed to have moved to California is a real problem. You shouldn't be voting in a state where you do not live," he said, adding pointedly, "She has voted illegally, though she's no longer a resident of the Peach State." According to the Georgia Secretary of State's office, Bassan was mailed an absentee ballot for the November 2016 election. It was sent to the address of her employer, Foothills Christian Church, in El Cajon. It wasn't until August 7th, 4 days after the La Mesa Spring Valley School District Superintendent Brian Marshall swore in Bassan as a school board member, that her Georgia voter registration was changed to inactive, a Georgia elections official confirmed, Times of San Diego reports. Republican Bassan, who registered to vote in San Diego County on July 25th, just 2 weeks before her school board appointment here, did not respond to repeated requests for comment by Times of San Diego. Neither did school's chief, Marshall. In an interview back in September, however, Bassan said she mistakenly assumed she was registering to vote when she applied for a California driver's license and checked a box to update her registration records. James Gardner, a state constitutional law professor at University at Buffalo School of Law in New York, said the key question is not where Bassan lives, but where her legal domicile is. Residence is where you live at a particular point in time, Gardner told Times of San Diego, but domicile is generally understood to mean something more substantial, like a person's permanent residence. residence. Thus, college students who attend schools out of state or members of the military or State Department can vote absentee in their home state while living elsewhere. Gardner said evidence of a voter's intent is relevant. The kind of evidence administrators and courts typically look at includes the state in which the person holds a driver's license, where they have a bank account, where they own residential property, and other evidence that sheds light on whether their current residence is temporary or permanent. As of last October 25th, Bassan's Georgia driver's license was currently valid, according to the Georgia Department of Driver Services, its version of the DMV. But the California DMV said it issued a driver's license to Bassan on June 5th of this year. The DMV requires that you must apply for a California driver's license within 10 days of establishing residency in the state. Gardner, a distinguished professor at New York State University, observed that Bassan may be asserting simultaneously to be domiciled in two places, which she says is not legally possible. No one can have more than one domicile at a time for purposes of voting. Lublin told Times of San Diego that he wasn't surprised that Bassan's Georgia voter registration persisted because the interstate purging system is not so great. Lublin added, "What's interesting here is that Republicans have become increasingly convinced that Democrats are committing voter fraud. And here you have a case of someone who's a Republican perpetrating voter fraud within a Republican state that claims to have clamped down on this through adoption of voter identification laws." According to her LinkedIn profile, Bassan, then Rebecca Winfrey, attended Calvary Chapel Bible College from 2014 to 2016 when she graduated with a theology and biblical studies degree. "She's got a real problem," Lublin said. "What seems to be the reality is that she was a resident of California since at least when her education ended, if not before that." Bassan moved to La Mesa around January 2016, her school board application suggests, so she would have been a California resident for at least 17 months when she got her California driver's license. She also signaled her intention to be a permanent resident by promising to run for school board next year. Under Georgia law, any person who votes or attempts to vote by absentee ballot at any primary or election and who knows that he or she is not qualified to vote is guilty of a felony. If convicted, Bassan could be sentenced to imprisonment for at least 1 year and up to 10 years, be subject to a fine up to $100,000 or both. Michael Vu, San Diego County's Registrar of Voters, deferred to the District Attorney's Office to evaluate whether a crime of voter fraud occurred. Tanya Sierra, a spokeswoman for the DA's office, declined to answer questions on the matter posed by Times of San Diego. But Lublin, the national elections expert, did not see any innocent explanation for Bassan's voting behavior. He concludes, "This is not an accident, not an oopsie-daisy."
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Green Scene Report. A new climate science special report, part of the Fourth National Climate Assessment, concludes that it is extremely likely that human activities are the dominant cause of global warming. The study is the most comprehensive ever conducted on climate science by the American government researchers and includes experts from NASA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the Department of Energy, and academic scientists. The 600-page report finds that the last 115 years are the warmest in the history of modern civilization, and that greenhouse gases from industry and agriculture are by far the biggest causes. The report was mandated by Congress before President Donald Trump took office, and the findings flatly contradict the Trump administration, which has consistently denied that climate change is real or that human activities are at fault for the increasing dangers posed by climate change. Trump has appointed climate change deniers to key positions, including the heads of the Environmental Protection Agency and other major departments. Trump has also said he will pull the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accord. The report predicts warming will get much worse without action to dramatically cut greenhouse gas emissions. The future will fuel more severe wildfires here and in the West, worse storms elsewhere, and sea levels rising already faster than in the past three millennium. It appears unlikely the report will spur any immediate action by the Trump administration, however. The president has failed to appoint anyone to fill a vacancy at the top of the Office of Science and Technology Policy, the very agency to which the climate report has been submitted.
A ballot initiative effort in Lemon Grove to loosen regulation of where medical marijuana dispensaries can be located has been snuffed out for now. Judge Kenneth Medell upheld a city clerk's decision to refuse to accept signatures submitted for a special election on the measure because voters were provided petitions with incomplete language on the proposed measure. Backers have until January 2018 to gather signatures from 15% of the city's registered voters to qualify for the ballot. Last November, Lemon Grove voters approved Measure 5, legalizing medical marijuana dispensaries by a scant 90 votes, but advocates of medical cannabis have contended that zoning restrictions are too tight. The new initiative, if it makes it onto the ballot and is approved by voters, would allow dispensaries in more locations, including near small daycare centers. It would also allow marijuana deliveries within the city limits and prohibit revoking a dispensary's permit unless it was found to constitute a serious threat and reckless disregard for public health, safety, and general welfare. Besides concerns over medical cannabis issues, some in the city also voiced concern over the $300,000 cost to hold a special election in Lemon Grove, a community already running a lean budget. Reporting for East County Magazine from Lemon Grove, this is Gene Carpenter.
If you're looking to adopt a cat, or several, the county's animal shelter in Bonita recently took in 127 cats rescued from a residence in Lakeside. Sheriff's deputies conducting a welfare check on a person at the home found the cats living in unclean conditions. The cats are undergoing veterinary evaluations but appear to be healthy, according to a county press release. These furry felines are in need of good homes. If you would like to view or adopt any of the rescued cats, you can call 619-767-2675 or visit the County Animal Shelter located at 5821 Sweetwater Road in Bonita.
This is Gene Carpenter with a health report. A 100-year-old woman is the second local flu death reported this season, the County Health and Human Services Agency has announced. The woman died from influenza A and had underlying medical conditions. Dr. Wilma Wooten, County Public Health Officer, says, "Influenza can lead to serious complications and even death, especially among the elderly. The best protection against the flu is getting vaccinated. Do it now before the flu starts to spread." For the week ending October 28th, 1% of all emergency department visits countywide were for influenza-like illness, with 31 cases confirmed. So far this season, 316 cases have been confirmed, more than triple the same time last season. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends that everyone 6 months and older get a flu shot every year. It takes 2 weeks for immunity to develop. Vaccination is especially important for people who are at high risk of developing serious complications from influenza. They include people with chronic medical conditions like asthma, diabetes, and lung disease, even if symptoms are under control. Pregnant women, people age 65 years and older, and people who live with or care for others who are at higher risk. In addition to getting vaccinated, people should also do the following to avoid getting sick. Wash hands thoroughly and often. Use hand sanitizers. Stay away from sick people. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Clean commonly touched surfaces. If you are sick, stay home and avoid contact with others. The flu vaccine is available at doctor's offices and retail pharmacies. If you don't have medical insurance, you can go to a county public health center to get vaccinated. For a list of locations, visit sdiz.org or call 211.
On Saturday, daylight savings time ended for the year. You've rolled back your clocks. But now County Fire Marshal Greg Schreiner urges you to also do a fast and easy review of your household safety plan. First, test all your home smoke detectors and carbon monoxide detectors to make sure they are working. This takes just a few minutes, but it is important because you're staking your lives on those devices if a fire breaks out in the middle of the night. Most smoke or carbon monoxide detectors have a button you can press to test the alarm. If you hear beeping, the battery is still good. Safety experts suggest checking the battery in your smoke detector on a monthly basis and replacing the battery every year, even if it's still working, ideally when you set your clocks back each fall. Newer smoke detector models may come equipped with a special battery that has a 10-year service life that is not replaceable. In this case, continue to test the battery monthly and replace the entire unit after 10 years. Generally, all smoke detectors should be replaced after 10 years to ensure that continued protection is in place. This simple step can save your life or your loved ones. More than half of fatal home fires occur from 11 p.m. to 7 a.m., when people are often sleeping. The risk of dying in a home fire is cut in half by having a working smoke detector installed, according to the U.S. Fire Administration. You can also take time to check your emergency supplies kit and replace stored water so it won't go stale. Also check the batteries in your kit, as well as food and medication items, to make sure those items have not expired. Emergency officials recommend that people rotate water and food out of their emergency supply kits every 6 months. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Valerie Watts.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing Donald H. Harrison, author of the new book, 77 Miles of Jewish Stories. This book, as the title suggests, takes the reader along on a 77-mile journey through I-8 to visit Jews at work as well as different Jewish institutions. My guest has also written three previous books, Schlepping Through the American West, Waxy, an American Family Business Success Story, and a biography of Louis Rose, San Diego's first Jewish settler. Wow, that's quite a mouthful. Welcome, Don. It's great having you on Bookshelf.
Thank you, Raina.
Let's start with your new book. In it, you introduce your reader to all kinds of Jewish workers, doctors, lawyers, an alpaca farmer, and football players. Give us a behind-the-scenes look at this travelogue. What was it like to encounter such diversity?
Well, Raina, being, you know, Jewish all my life, I expected the diversity, but what I didn't know was what there would be on the next freeway exit. The concept behind the book was get on the freeway, get off at every exit, find a Jewish story. Some were easy, because there were Jewish institutions, but other ones were, you had to go searching for it. You had to go reconnoiter first and finally find a suggestion of a possibility and then find the story. But the reason that I did this is because I sense that there's a nexus between a location, a place, and a story. I'll give you an example. Let's imagine I was going to give you a lecture on the War of 1812. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you'd fall asleep in about 5 minutes into it. But if I were to give you that same lecture, and let's say we were in the harbor in Baltimore looking at Fort McHenry, perhaps from the same vantage point that Francis Scott Key had, just before he wrote The Star-Spangled Banner, suddenly you and other listeners might be much more interested. So I have always gravitated towards finding stories that have places prominently within them. For me, this developed over some years. I had been serving as the press secretary to the acting mayor of San Diego, Bill Cleeter, when Queen Elizabeth II came to visit San Diego. And we had to put together for the visiting press, there was over 700 of them, a little guide to all the different places that Her Majesty would be visiting. There were something like 18 venues that she visited. And those descriptions of those places, which were pulled together from the institutions themselves, found their way into many of those stories. Another time I had a public relations agency and we helped to start the Old Town Trolley Tours of San Diego. And that is very much site-specific. You write a script, and it has to be the trolley conductor needs to be there and speaking about it the moment the trolley is passing a particular site. And so I found that people are really interested in what they're seeing if someone could tell them about it as they see it. There have been other instances, but that's what led me to the idea of site-specific journalism.
It's like you specialize in living history and finding it and creating it.
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement.
When you got off at the exit, sometimes you would start with an institution, but how did you find people?
Well, I'm a member of a synagogue in the East County, Tiferet Israel Synagogue, and so a lot of our members live out that way. And I would say, well, do you know anybody that's lives off of exit 34 or 35 or, you know, and so forth? And people did, so I would get some suggestions. Other times, as I mentioned, you just get off the freeway on your own and you start driving around, you start noting what's there, and then you go back to your internet and you start researching these various places and see if there's something that connects.
So a combination of the internet and schmoozing.
Yeah, schmoozing.
Well, which interview stands out the most in your mind that's in this book? Or is there one that you found most surprising or entertaining or fascinating for some reason?
Yeah, I would use the term fascinating because there are several interviews that really got into the interrelationships between Jews and other ethnic groups or religious groups.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the kinds of stories that I really find very interesting. So there are stories about Jews and Roman Catholics, there are Jews and Chaldean Catholics, Jews and African Americans, Jews and Native Americans, and so forth, lots of different groups. And as I got to write those stories, I got to learn not only about my own culture, but about theirs.
So can you identify one interview? Does one stand out in your mind?
I do have one that maybe I'll even have the chance to read on this show about Native Americans, which I think shows some interesting parallels between the Native American experience and the Jewish experience.
Yes, let's do that. Let's have you read an excerpt from your book.
All right. It is for anyone that's interested. I'm talking about Exit 33, the Viejas Indian Reservation. There was a dinner sometime before, actually was off the reservation, but it dealt with people who live there, particularly the head of the Viejas band, and that's Anthony Pico. And Anthony Pico had been honored by the American Jewish Committee for all of the things that he had done. And I'm going to read from his response. He surprised them. He kind of turned the tables. Whereas they wanted to honor him, he decided to honor the Jewish community. And he said, you know, we've both faced extermination and survived a Holocaust. Indians were not sent to gas chambers. Our prisoners of war camps came with blankets infected with disease that were more lethal than even bullets. In their zeal and greed to reach their manifest destiny, the strangers took our land and took pride in the slogan that the only good Indian is a dead Indian. In California, it was legal to shoot an Indian on sight, to purchase homeless Indians in auctions for slave labor, and steal Indian children from their parents to, quote, save, unquote, them from their primitive ways. Our religious ceremonies were banned as satanical, and many have been lost from our memory as a result. Pico went on to say that as a Native American, he can, quote, sympathize with the ferocious love and militancy Jews bring to protecting Israel. We know the value of having a homeland, a place where you are free to exercise your own destiny and be a family. How Jews have managed to survive as a people amidst strangers and strange lands without a land for so many centuries is an absolute miracle as far as I'm concerned. He said, our reservations aren't as grand as our original lands, but they represent the continuation, security, and future to us. Native Americans, like Jews, will always rise to fight when our homelands are threatened. Tonight it seems appropriate for me to return the honor and pay tribute to the gifts that the Jewish community shares with all the world, the Viejas chairman said. One of the most important is showing how our people, struggling to be free, can preserve our humanity when the world chooses to treat us inhumanely. Jews have always been the first to speak out against injustice and inhumane practices in the United States. I know the greatness in your heart and spirit comes from the terrors of the past. I also know from experience that it is not an easy thing to do to maintain tolerance and empathy for others when your own life is at stake. Living defensively takes a toll on the human spirit.
Wow. That's really beautiful.
Yeah, he really had an impact on the crowd. There were many tears in the audience's mm-hmm. eyes as they recognized the similarity. And I think that's for us as writers, authors, journalists, being able to point those similarities out to show the connection that we have, even though we seem to come from so many different places. It's one of the important things that we can do.
Right. We don't automatically think of Native Americans having so much in common with Jewish people.
Well, you know, of course, we refer to ourselves as a tribe, too. You
know? Right. Right. Well, I know that you're also a journalist. Since 1962, you've been a journalist, right? And working for the UCLA Daily Bruin, the Los Angeles Times, and the San Diego Union. And since 1986, you've written your Jewish stories not only about San Diego, but about the rest of the world. So how does your day job figure into what you're doing as an author? You're a publisher and editor of the San Diego Jewish World. Does that influence you and inspire you to write your books, or how is it connected?
Well, it's very much connected in that every day I'm covering the Jewish world, and so every day I'm running into stories that I can retell at a later time. I had a cousin, his name was Richard Yaffe, and Dick was a very well-known Jewish journalist on the East Coast. He was the UN correspondent for the Jewish Chronicle of London, and he wrote for the Jewish Week of New York, and he was very, very well-known. And one time he was sitting in my living room, and I said, gee, the Jewish world, isn't that too narrow a subject for you? I mean, don't you feel that it's awful limiting? And kindly, but nevertheless, he laughed at me, and he said, limiting? He says, it's all I can do to even possibly keep up, because Jewish journalism is very much like local or regional journalism. The concept is to find a story that relates to your people, and whether it be your people in your region, like in the East County, mm-hmm. or whether it be your people who are ethnically or religiously of your group, and then to show how they relate to the larger stories that we cover. And so I find myself covering very, very large stories all the time, but looking specifically for the Jewish angle in those stories.
So it's sharing stories too, communication between the groups, the smaller group and the larger group.
Yeah, very definitely so.
In your last book, Schlepping Through the American West, love that title, you and your grandson went on an odyssey from San Diego to Alberta, Canada. So how does this 77-mile journey on the I-8 differ from that other travelogue?
Well, the Schlepping Through the American West was really a 3,000-mile tour. If you, by the time you go up the 15 to Canada and then come back, you've put quite a few miles on your car. This was just 77 miles, and I was more constrained. I had to get off at every exit and find a Jewish story there. I couldn't pick and choose like I did on the longer tour.
So the shorter one was harder in a sense.
In a sense, because, yeah. I had to find my story right there. And the concept, we have on our newspaper, the motto over our masthead, our online newspaper is there's a Jewish story everywhere. And the concept was, let's go out and prove it. And that's why we did it this way, is to, you know, we started at the beach, at where the I-8 begins, and we took it all the way to the Imperial County line. And that's the 77 miles of I-8. There are 35 exits in that period. And we found 70 stories, an average of two an exit, at least one at every one.
It sounds like fun.
It is fun. And I think that any ethnicity could do it. If mm-hmm. Somebody who's out there listening who's Irish or who's Mexican-American or who is Asian, Chinese, Japanese, whatever your ethnicity, I think, particularly in California, it would be easy to replicate that kind of a trip, but reach into your own historic background.
How long did it take you, the whole thing?
Well, the series ran initially on San Diego Jewish World, one a week. And so I got myself a head start on it. And then while it was, the series was running, I was a couple exits ahead on the freeway.
Right.
So altogether about 2 years.
Great. Well, you've been referred to as a highly valued wandering Jew rather than a wandering Jew. In your view, how are your stories, you talked about this a little already, but how are they particularly relevant to people from different backgrounds and faith?
Well, I think that there's a great curiosity about Jews among non-Jews. At least I've encountered it. People ask me questions all the time about mm-hmm. why we do this, why we do that. And this book provides some of the answers, especially those stories within it that deal with the institutions that are run along the I-8. For example, we cover some synagogues, a mikveh, which is the ceremonial bath, you might say, that a person takes for conversion or mm-hmm. for family purity reasons. So those customs are covered in the book. So if someone has that interest, for sure. But also because we write as well about some of their faiths in terms of the interactions they may be having with with the Jewish community. And so hopefully that's interesting to them. And then some of the stories are universal. You know, it just so happens that the person involved is Jewish, but anybody could be an alpaca farmer. You don't have to be Jewish to do that. Or anyone could be perhaps somebody like Catherine Hand, who has a facility that uses horses to help people overcome their various disabilities, riding and so forth. It's an equestrian center. And so they're very fascinating people who they're Jewish, but they're also, you might say, there's general interest about what they do.
And I'm thinking also universal themes such as survival.
Exactly, exactly. And some of the stories are sports stories, and doesn't everybody love sports?
Right.
You know, so.
So one last question.
Sure.
What are you writing next?
Well, actually, next I'm compiling stories from the past about places that I visited with Jewish stories across the country and all around the world. And I'm going to put those into one book, and maybe even more, depending on just how many we got there.
And when should we expect to see the first one?
Oh, I think it's going to be sometime next year. Let's get this one out first.
Okay. Okay. Well, our time is up, but thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed being with you.
For more information on Donald H. Harrison's books, please visit sdjewishworld.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Monday, November the 6th, 2017. I'm Mike Clifford. On today's nationwide rundown, a gunman with an assault rifle goes on a shooting rampage at a rural Texas church. Illinois lawmakers headed to sexual assault awareness training. A decision on temporary protection for hundreds of thousands of immigrants due out today. And lights out for a journalism innovator on the West Coast. Now our top story, it is the worst mass shooting in the history of the state of Texas, and it follows by just 5 weeks the carnage in Las Vegas. A 26-year-old man with an assault rifle opened fire on the congregation inside the First Baptist Church of Sutherland Springs, located just due east of San Antonio. More than two dozen people were killed inside the church, with the victims ranging in age from 5 to 72. Authorities say the shooter was pursued into the next county, where he was shot and killed. The U.S. Air Force confirms he served in the military, but was discharged in 2016. Sexual harassment's been in the spotlight in Hollywood lately. Veronica Carter reports awareness and prevention training is in store for members of the Illinois state legislature.
Colin Williams, policy director for the Illinois Campaign for Political Reform, says awareness training is a first step, but state lawmakers need to take a stand and pass laws addressing both prevention and punishment.
Especially the male legislators, to make a commitment to a proactive, transparent plan for preventing sexual harassment and addressing claims when they do arise. These changes can't be just a short-term movement. They have to be a long-term commitment to improving the climate in Springfield.
There's an open letter circulating around the state capitol to collect signatures from women who describe harassment and intimidation.
Harassment claims in Illinois used to be investigated by the Office of the Legislative Inspector General, but that position has been vacant since mid-2014.
Today is the deadline for federal officials to make a decision about whether to continue the temporary protected status designation for Honduras. Deadlines also loom for El Salvador and Haiti. Nicole Slanka with the Center for American Progress says nearly 300,000 people from these nations have TPS status, and the majority are working and contributing to the economy.
Anyone who is temporary protected status from Honduras has to have been in the country since 1998. And anyone who has temporary protected status and is from El Salvador has to have been in the United States since 2001. So we're talking about groups of people who have been in the United States for nearly 20 years.
Immigrants from El Salvador, Honduras, and Haiti comprise 90% of all TPS holders in the country.
On Friday, the U.S. House approved a bill to refinance the Children's Health Insurance Program, but Eric Gelattis reports that funding is still in doubt.
9 million children nationwide, including 75,000 in Colorado, get their health insurance through CHIP. Funding for the program expired on October 1st. The Republican bill that passed the House would offset the program's costs by slashing funding for public health services and denying health care to pregnant women and children while billing issues are resolved. According to Elliot Fishman with Families USA, it would cancel the health insurance if a marketplace premium payment is just 1 month overdue.
The estimate is that that would cut almost 700,000 people off from insurance every year if they move to that very short grace period before people are cut off.
In the Senate, at least 8 Democrats would have to join with the entire Republican majority to approve the measure, making passage of the bill very unlikely.
And finally, Suzanne Potter tells us California is losing a venerable independent news agency.
New America Media just announced it will be closing its doors on November 30th. The nonprofit started in 1970 in San Francisco as Pacific News Service. The name may not be familiar, but its articles became a staple for hundreds of newspapers around the country. Executive Director Sandy Close says its writers broke many major stories about the war in Vietnam.
It was among the first to provide eyewitness accounts on the impact of the air war and Agent Orange, fragging when GIs turned on their own leaders. And we had the last American reporter in Cambodia after the fall.
In the 1980s, the organization became New American Media and launched a number of publications designed to amplify the voices of low-income youth, some from behind bars, to combat the myth of the super predator.
Some of the projects the organization hopes to continue concern issues such as immigrant rights, the 2020 census, and the future of watersheds in California. I'm Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
We're on the road in East County, visiting some amazing towns and meeting some incredible people across our region. Welcome to another adventure on East County Magazine's On the Road.
This is Miriam Raftery.
And this is Leon Thompson. Today we're on the road in Julian, California, a historic gold rush town in the mountains of East County, San Diego.
Now back in 1870, the town was founded by Drury Bailey and his cousin, Mike Julian. The two cousins were Confederate soldiers during the Civil War, both taken prisoner by the Yankees. After they got out and the war ended, they found their homeland had been laid waste by General Sherman's march to the sea, so they and other family members decided to head west. But Drury missed the boat to Panama, so he went overland instead. He did some hard rock mining in Montana, but then he ran out of money. So he flagged down a wagon train, and by a fortunate stroke of fate, he found that his brother was the driver. Drury founded the town of Julian in 1870 and named it after his cousin, Michael Julian. Traumatized by the war, Drury wanted to help others start new lives. So he gave away plots of land to anyone who agreed to build a home right away, as well as giving plots away for a school, a church, a jail, a town hall, and a chamber of commerce. Now, it wasn't hard to convince people to move to this remote mountain town, since that same year, Julian resident Fred Coleman reportedly paused to give his mule some water and discovered gold in what is now known as Coleman Creek, and the Julian Gold Rush was on.
Today, we've brought along our team of interns to tell you about the hidden treasures in this town of Julian, California, where you can relive the Gold Rush days nearly a century and a half ago.
Hello, this is Trevor Hill, and I'm here with historian David Lewis. Thank you for being here, David.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So I'm just going to ask you a few questions about Julian. First, I wanted to know, who were the people who founded the town?
Basically, Drury Bailey and Mike Julian were the only people who were really involved in the town. Drury had homesteaded all this land, and then in 1870, when the major hard rock mines were discovered, that's when he hired a surveyor to lay out the town. So that's when I say it started, was February of 1870.
Who was Fred Coleman?
Fred Coleman is a black man that was in the area way before Julian was founded. We have him on the San Diego County tax rolls in 1863, which is kind of interesting. That's when two of the major battles of the Civil War took place. So it's right in the middle of the Civil War. So what's Fred doing here at that time period is interesting by itself. We don't have any answers to that. We probably never will. But Fred, he was apparently, according to local lore, had cattle here, He was friendly with the local Indians. We know that because he eventually married an Indian woman, Maria Jesus Anejo. Fred was apparently out looking after his cattle and stopped to water his horse in a creek. Again, this is local lore. They really expand on it sometimes, telling that he took his frying pan out of his saddlebags and all this, but we don't know any of this. We just know that Fred was the guy that discovered the gold. Apparently, Fred couldn't keep a secret, because pretty quick there were a bunch of people panning in that creek. And that was placer gold, the can you do pan for in water in a creek. But it didn't last very long. And so then they started working their way up the creek to find the source of the gold. And that's when they found it in these hills north of town.
And how did the discovery of that gold change Julian?
Well, Julian didn't even exist when that gold was discovered. So that was like the launch point for everything that happened around here. When word got back that they had found successful mine workings up here, and the first loads of ore ended up downtown on display and taken up to San Francisco for milling and assaying, that launched Julian.
Wow. Do you have any colorful stories that you've heard about the gold rush or just Julian in general?
There's lots of colorful stories. I'm the historian for the cemetery, too, and people always ask me who the most interesting person from Julian that's buried in that cemetery. And it's Drury Bailey, the man that founded this town. Because when he founded this town, he went and he fought in the Civil War right after he got out of high school. Terrible deal. The family lost all of their land back there, and they end up here. And Drury homesteads all this land, and then, like I say, gets that surveyor. Drury's 26 years old when he did this. I find that pretty amazing because I was still looking for some gas for my car and hoping for a date when I was 26 years old. And this man starts a town. He made a pretty good reputation for himself as being a generous person, but he also had a lot of foresight.
Interesting. Can you tell us about this building that we're in right now, the Pioneer History Museum?
This building started out life. It was built by Joseph Treschel, who was a blacksmith, and he ran it for a few years. This was in the 1890s, and then he sold it, or leased it, I'm not sure which, to Peter Meyerhofer, who brewed beer here. And then it went back to another blacksmith, Christian Grosskopf, who blacksmithed here, and that was the last thing that I know that happened in here. It fell to ruin. All that was left are these rock walls in here. Wow. And in 1952, the Women's Club took it upon themselves to get some county money and some volunteers, and they rebuilt what you see here.
Wow.
So there's been a little expansion out the front, and we're doing a little expansion out the south end right now. But
These are the original stone walls that we're seeing around
those us? Those right there, yes. And
wow.
Those were probably mined right here on site. That's Julian Schist. S-C-H-I-S-T, just to clarify that. Anyway, that is what is unique to this Julian area, and it's the quartz within that schist where the gold is found. So when they flattened this area out, they were cutting that stuff off, and it comes off in slabs because it's sedimentary,
mm-hmm.
and it's hard, mm-hmm. and then it's stackable. That's how these walls came about, was right from what was here.
Wow.
How often can you do that anymore?
Do you have any favorite exhibits here at the museum?
Well, probably my favorite is the Bailey exhibit because I almost feel like family. I know as much or probably more than a lot of the family does about them because that's been my focus. It has a few personal things in there, but my favorite one is that pick that's exhibited in there. It's not necessarily a pick that you would use for mining ore. It's for picking out samples. And he was injured in the mine in 1899, disappeared from the logbook for a while on the payroll.
Mm-hmm.
And when he came back, he had fashioned that pick as a cane also.
Wow.
So it's a little short, you might know. And
hit a hunch, maybe.
not Drury. Drury. This is the giant founder of the town is 5'3" tall. So I've got a little picture that I did once. I photoshopped him in, me and my documentation, right? I photoshopped him in next to me and put a ruler between us just to show the difference of what we look like.
Wow. Thank you so much for answering my questions.
You're very welcome.
Anyone can come here and talk to David on Sundays you're here?
I'm usually here off and on. Okay. Lately, I've been able to get Drury's grandson, Richard Bailey. Anybody that comes up here can talk to the grandson of the founder of the town.
I have one more question. When did the mine close, the Julian mines?
All in varying stages. There was no real just shutdown. People kept piddling around. Mm-hmm. They're still out there piddling around.
Wow, really?
Yeah. You know, especially when times get hard. People mm-hmm. are out there trying to get lucky. But, say from 1900, they were pretty much done, but then my grandfather's draft record shows he was a hoist operator at the Golden Chariot, and that would have been about 1918. Now we mine tourists.
Well, okay, thank you again.
You're welcome.
Up next, we're going to have Jaden Jimenez tell us about what he found most interesting about the museum here.
While I was looking through the museum, one of the more interesting things that I found was a railroad spring. It was on a railroad cart. And what they did is they got the spring and put it in the Victorian Town Hall here in Julian. And basically, it was for the dance floor. So when there was large groups of people, they would dance and it would actually really add a springy effect. So I thought that was pretty interesting. One of the only spring floors left is actually in the Hotel del Coronado.
Wow, that's so interesting. Thank you, Dayton.
What do you think, guys? How would you like to go try your hand at some gold mining?
I'm feeling lucky.
All right, let's go.
This is Devon Marshall, and we're here at the Eagle Mine in Julian, which is open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to mid to late afternoon or so if you want to tour the mine or try your hand at panning for gold. Now I'm going to be talking to Mr. Craig Nelson, whose family owns and operates the mines, and with Kim Gordon, one of our guys today.
My grandpa, he ran this from about the late 60s all the way till he passed away. Then my dad took over, and then he passed away about 10 years ago. And then me and my brothers that took over, and we're really blessed to have a grandpa that decided not to dig the gold out of the mountain because that's a lot harder of a job. Taking you folks through that mountain and teaching the history is a lot fun.
So then the real gold is the tourism.
Well, the education.
Okay.
I'll tell you, because the tourists that come to Julian, California, and I always, I'll tell you, the local town museum down there, which is Mr. Lewis,
right.
And those folks, and we just did Kim did a nice seminar down here at the library the other night, and you know, a lot of the kids don't realize what it takes to gold mine back in the 1870s and how they just barely made a living with this type of method. And they all want keyboards and phones and, you know, the technology of today. They don't pick up the pick and shovel and you know, do 8, 10, 12-hour shifts under hard rock mining. And that's what we want to show you is it's hard to get a guy to do that kind of work anymore.
So Steven, one of our interns, is here, and he's going to try his hand at some of the panning for gold. Can you come over and give him a couple pointers on how to do this?
You want the sand to go over the ridges. That's why they make the tools. It's black to keep the metals separated. You can see the colors.
Uh-huh.
So like you said, you scrape to the bottom. Now what I do, once you get it in the pan, I settle it, shake it. Because then you get control of the sand by settling the gold to the bottom of the pan. Then when you get to the gold to the bottom of the pan, you simply let the pan and the water do the work for you because that's what it's made to do. But you know what the first gold pan used to be back in the 1800s? The gold horn. We got a gold horn in there, so what they did is cut the end of the horns off. It's a U-shape, right? You'd scrape it down into the stream, and you'd rock it back and forth. The gold being heavy stays in the metal. Unfortunately, I'm not going to go cut some horn off of a steer or something like that and get the end of the horn. Take the pan, and then once you settle the gold and you're happy with it, then you just let the water in the pan wash the sand out because the gold's heavier and it goes to the bottom.
Okay, so we have Steven over here who's been trying his hand at it. Steven,
what's his yield?
Come tell us how it's going.
It's been going good. I found myself a lot of gold and the techniques that Kim,
our favorite tour guide, one of our friends and family.
It actually worked.
Yeah, ooh, look
now,
at all that.
What you want to do is concentrate. We want to see what you got as a collector. Get it all to the end of the pan, concentrate it by tapping it. Keep water in the pan. And then it separates, just like up at the mill. The sand will always go first, and the gold, being the heaviest, will drag out of the back with the black, that's the iron, separates by the metal like the mill up there. And you tap it, and you start rolling it. And the gold being heavier, we're going to chase the gold tail, as they call it. And look at how it comes and drags out the back. So now doesn't that look prettier? The
now
way that
talking.
You could look at it like that.
Eureka!
Eureka! Your gold strike. So that's what you get. That's about $10, $12 worth of a gold tail right there. Now we're going to start at the eagle at it. Because instead of an entrance to the gold mine, they call an adit. A-D-I-T is a puzzle.
What could we expect when we go down to do the mine tour?
Well, what we're going to expect is we're going to go over to the entrance and we're going to learn how do you know where to start your tunnel? Because they couldn't pan for gold with the streams drying up. So we're going to go over the mountain. We're going to look at the way that the layers and the mountain structured. And we're going to show you how they go into the mountain and abstract the gold-bearing ore, the quartz, out of the mountain. You just learned how to get the gold out of the quartz by the California 5 stand mill. Now remember, that machine would operate right on that foundation right there. And we moved it up there when my grandpa made this a tour business. That way you had two-stage tour area right there. And once you move 22 tons, you don't move it back as you go. So we're going to show you how they go through that mountain and pull out the gold-bearing ore, and you already seen how to process it. So let's go see how we can get that quartz, the gold-bearing ore, out of the mountain.
Okay, we can send our interns down into the mine. You guys ready?
Oh, yeah.
All right.
We're going to cover.
Bye.
Yeah. Well, it's nice knowing you. We'll see you in about 50 years of being abandoned on the mountain.
This is Leon, and we're down in Julian, California, and our interns are back. How did it go on the mine shaft?
Oh, well, it was really great. We got to learn a lot of stuff, and it was really interesting, you know, learning the history. One of the coolest things that I thought that happened while we were in the mine is while we were in, you know, all the lights are on, you can see, you know, decently well, but he took us to this room where there was a candle, and he turned off all the lights, all of the lights to light up the mine, and it was complete darkness. There's no light source coming in whatsoever. And so we lit the candle so we could see how, you know, the old miners used to see just such dim light, and they had to deal with this for 10 hours a day. And so, yeah.
My favorite part of the mine tour was seeing all the gadgets that the miners used back then. And one gadget in particular was the Widowmaker, which was a nomadic drill. It was created to carve deeper into the cave. The nomadic drill would drill into the rocks, and then they would put dynamite in the holes, and the dynamite would explode, causing a lot of dust to affect the lungs of the miners, causing them to have lung cancer. And that's why they call it the Widowmaker.
Well, my favorite part of the tour was we got to this point in the mine where there was a shaft that went straight down for 425 feet, and our tour guide showed us the bucket that they used to pull ore up from the mine, and it turns out that they also used it as an elevator. And there was this huge steam-powered machine that cranked the rope because it's such a long drop, you can't really have people trusted to hoist someone up that far. And there was a bell on the machine that was so loud, and it was to give signals. Different amounts of rings meant different things. And it was so loud, and it echoed throughout the entire mine, and I just thought it was really cool.
So what do you think? So how would you guys have liked to make your living as a hard rock miner?
I'll leave that to the old-timey miner people.
Tough work, huh? Well, I bet you guys have worked up an appetite.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, walking all over town, going down the mine. All right, well, let's go find something wonderful to eat. And there's no shortage of great places to eat up here in Julian.
Especially if you're looking for apple pie. Because Julian's goal these days is the tourists that come here to enjoy this wonderful town. Let's go eat!
This is Jaden Jimenez with East County Magazine, and I'm here with Charles Scott. He works at Candied Apples and here in Julian, so can you tell us a little bit about history about Candied Apples in Julian?
You bet, yes. My name's Charles. I'm the pastry chef and owner of the Candied Apple Pastry Company in Julian. We've been here for 11 years. Julian's kind of got a very interesting history with apples. It started with the gold miners who settled in this community in the late 1800s. They found that they could grow apples very easy here. In the early 1900s, they sent a bushel of apples to one of the world expos and won a gold medal. And that put Julian on the map for apples. Of course, supply and economics changed the world of apples up here a little bit. As Julian grew, some of the apple farms were turned into housing developments, wineries, and of course some of the apple growers retired. But there's still quite a lot of apples being grown up here, from a range of apple cider apples to you-pick apples to organic apples.
And apple pies.
And apple pie. Yeah. Yeah, the apple pie history actually goes back probably to the Farmer family. Bud Farmer was an apple grower up here, and his wife used to make apple pies. This is dating back probably 40 years. As they handed off the business, Liz Smothers from the Julian Pie Company and Anita Knowles from Mom's took that over and kept the apple pie business alive up here in Julian and have kept that name quite alive. Of course, the Julian Pie Company, that works very well. Our little bakery is a European bakery and bistro concept. Of course, being in Julian, you have to make apple pie, so we do make apple pie.
Yeah,
along with many other things, like 12 kinds of breads. I have a 7-year-old sourdough starter started in the French way from a white wine yeast. We do pastries, desserts, wedding cakes, catering, full-service lunch menu, and, of course, French crepes.
Wow. How did you get started with this store?
With this store? Well, this store was a transition from 35 years of hard work. I started in the industry as a young boy doing dishes, got promoted to cooking because I said I didn't want to do dishes anymore. Worked my way through the industry, some fine hotels, did my formal training in New York at the International Pastry Arts Center. Ended up in Borrego Springs as the executive chef of a hotel there, and in there at La Casa del Zorro. And in the process of them closing down and selling out, this bakery was on the market, and I chose to buy it 8 years ago.
Wow, that's wonderful.
And it's been 8 years of quite the wild ride of producing delicious desserts, pastries, breads, wedding cakes, birthday cakes.
So can you tell us a little bit about the community here? I know earlier you were talking about how so many people come in.
Julian's, I mean, it's like I said, it's got a very diverse history. Today, Julian has really put itself on the map as a tourist community. Anybody who comes to San Diego, is part of the program is to see Julian, hear the history of Julian. I've met people from all parts of the world, the Far East, the Mideast, quite a few European travelers, Sweden, Germany, Italian, and, of course, America. I mean, I've met people from all over the world who come in the bakery here. It's very fun.
Wow, that's really interesting. Thank you for interviewing with us. This was great. We're going to enjoy this delicious lunch. Got a few sandwiches and crepes. A
couple of paninis and some crepes, you bet. Thank you for joining us.
Candied apples, we're looking forward to trying those.
For dessert. There we go. You got to save room for dessert. Life is uncertain. Save room for dessert.
Thank you.
So we'll be back soon with another edition of On the Road in East County. We're signing off from Julian, California.
This is John Fisteer with a health report. The death toll from hepatitis A in San Diego County has now reached 20, with 536 cases confirmed since November of last year, when the outbreak began. There is some good news, however. The rate of new cases has been falling in recent weeks, but since hepatitis has a long incubation period, more new cases are anticipated locally. In addition, cases tied to the San Diego strain of hepatitis A have now been identified in Arizona, Colorado, and other parts of California. Nearly two-thirds of the victims have been either homeless, users of illicit drugs, or both, according to the county health department. In El Cajon, where patient zero is believed to have been from, the city council last week temporarily banned feeding of homeless people in public places, such as parks, though only until the epidemic is over. The ban does not apply to other public gatherings, such as family reunions or birthday parties in parks. To date, the county has spent over $4 million to combat hepatitis A, including power washing streets, installing hand washing stations, and providing vaccinations to at-risk populations and those who serve them. The disease, which causes liver damage, is most often transmitted by sharing food or touching items handled by infected persons, as well as through sexual contact with someone who is infected with the virus.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Liz Alper, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, royalty-free music, and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.